Welcome back to the Book Club Commune with me, your host, Ivy Poese. Today we're moving on to a new book, State and Revolution by Vladimir Lenin. We're going to get into chapter one, the class society and the state, here in a little bit. There are some trains going around today and people driving around, so if that ends up in the background, then that's just how it is. I hope you enjoy. My voice gives away a little bit towards the end because this is the longest I've recorded in one session for a while. So, forgive me a little bit for my voice tittering out at the beginning and towards the end, just because it was getting tired and I had to take a few breaks to record this. But I hope you enjoy, and let's get on with it. Chapter 1. Class Society and the State. Part 1. The State as the product of the irreconcilability of class antagonisms. What is now happening to Marxist doctrine has, in the course of history, often happened to the doctrines of other revolutionary thinkers and leaders of oppressed classes struggling for emancipation. During the lifetime of great revolutionaries, the oppressing classes relentlessly persecute them and treat their teachings with malicious hostility, the most furious hatred, and the most unscrupulous campaign of lies and slanders. After their deaths, attempts are made to convert them into harmless icons, to canonize them, so to say, and to surround their names with a certain halo for consolation of the oppressed classes with the object of duping them, while at the same time emasculating the revolutionary doctrine of its content, vulgarizing it, and blunting its revolutionary edge. At the present time, the bourgeoisie and the opportunists in the labor movement concur in this revision of Marxism. They omit, obliterate, and distort the revolutionary side of its doctrine and its revolutionary soul. They push to the foreground and exalt what is or what seems acceptable to the bourgeoisie. All the social chauvinists are now Marxists. Don't laugh. And more frequently, German bourgeois professors, erstwhile specialists in the extermination of Marxism, are speaking of the national German Marx, who, they aver, trained labor unions which are so splendidly organized for the purpose of conducting a predatory war. In such circumstances, in view of the incredibly widespread nature of the distortions of Marxism, our first task is to restore the true doctrine of Marx on the state. For this purpose, it will be necessary to quote at length from the works of Marx and Engels. Of course, long quotations will make the text cumbersome and will not help to make it popular reading, but we cannot possibly avoid them. All are, at any rate, of the most essential passages in the works of Marx and Engels on the subject of the state must necessarily be given as fully as possible, in order that the reader may form an independent opinion on the totality of the views of the founders of scientific socialism and on the development of those views, and in order that their distortion by the now prevailing Kautskyism may be documentarily proved and clearly demonstrated. Let us begin with the most popular of Engels' works, Der Ursprung der Familie des Privatamtums und des Staats, or in English, Origin of the Family, Private Property, and the State, the sixth edition of which was published in Stuttgart as far back as 1894. We must translate the quotations from the German originals, as the Russian translations, although very numerous, are for the most part either incomplete or very unsatisfactory. Summing up his historical analysis, Engels says, quote, "The state is therefore by no means a power imposed on society from the outside. Just as little is it the reality of the moral idea, image and reality of reason, as Hegel asserts. Rather, it is a product of society at a certain stage of development. It is the admission that this society has become entangled in the insoluble contradiction with itself, that it is cleft into irreconcilable antagonisms, which it is powerless to dispel. But in order that these antagonisms, classes with conflicting economic interests, might not consume themselves in society in sterile struggle, a power Apparently, standing above society became necessary for the purpose of moderating the conflict and keeping it within the bounds of order. And this power, arising out of society, but placing itself above it and increasingly alienating itself from it, is the state. End quote. This fully expresses the basic idea of Marxism on the question of the historical role and meaning of the state. The state is the production and the manifestation of irreconcilability of the class antagonisms. The state arises when, where there are to an extent, that class antagonism cannot be objectively reconciled. And conversely, the existence of the state proves that the class antagonisms are irreconcilable. It's precisely on this most important and fundamental point that distortions of Marxism proceeding along two main lines begin. On the one hand, the bourgeois ideologists, and particularly the petty bourgeois ideologists, compelled by the pressure of indisputable historical facts to admit that the state only exists where there are class antagonisms and the class struggle, correct Marx in a way that makes it appear that the state is an organ for the conciliation of classes. According to Marx, the state could neither arise nor continue to exist if it were possible to conciliate classes. According to the petty bourgeois and Philistine professors and publicists, frequently on the question of well-meaning references to Marx, the state conciliates classes. According to Marx, the state is an organ of class rule, an organ for the oppressor of one class by another. It creates order, for which legalizes and perpetuates this oppression by moderating the collision between the classes and the opinion of the petty bourgeois politicians. Order means the conciliation of classes, not the oppression of one class by another. To moderate collisions means conciliating and not depriving the oppressed classes of definite means and methods of fighting to overthrow the oppressors. For instance, when in the revolution of 1917, the question of the real meaning and role of the state arose in all its magnitude as a practical question demanding immediate action on a wide mass scale. All the social revolutionaries and Mensheviks immediately and completely sank to the petty bourgeois theory that the state conciliates classes. Innumerable resolutions and articles by politicians of both these parties are thoroughly saturated with this purely petty bourgeois and Philistine conciliation theory. Petty bourgeois democracy is never able to understand that the state is the organ of the rule of a definite class which cannot be reconciled with its antipode, the class opposite to it. Their attitude towards the state is one of the most striking proofs that our socialist revolutionaries and Mensheviks are not socialists at all, which we Bolsheviks have always maintained, but petty bourgeois democrats with near-socialist phraseology. On the other hand, that Kautskyan distortion of Marxism is far more subtle. Theoretically, it is not denied that the state is an organ of class rule, or that class antagonisms are irreconcilable, but what is lost sight of or glossed over is this. If the state is the product of irreconcilable class antagonisms, if it is a power standing above society and increasingly alienating itself from it, it is clear that the liberation of the oppressed class is impossible, not only without violent revolution, but also without the destruction of the apparatus of state power, which was created by the ruling class and which is the embodiment of this alienation. As we shall see later, Marx very definitely drew this theoretical self-evident conclusion from a concrete historical analysis on the task of the revolution. And as we shall show, fully in our subsequent remarks, it is precisely this conclusion which Kautsky has forgotten and distorted. Part 2. A special bodies of armed men prisoned, etc. Engels continues, quote, as against the ancient Gentile organization, the primary distinguishing feature of the state is the division of subjects of the state according to territory, end quote. Such a division seems natural to us, but it cost a prolonged struggle against the old form of tribal or Gentile society. Quote, the second is the establishment of a public power, which is no longer directly identical with the population organizing itself as an armed power. The special public power is necessary because a self-acting armed organization of the population has become impossible since the cleavage into classes. This public power exists in every state. It consists not merely of armed men, but of material appendages, prisons, and coercive institutions of all kinds, of which Gentile society knew nothing. End quote. Engel further elucidates the concept of power, which is termed the state, a power which arises from society, but which places itself above it and becomes more and more alienated from it. What does this power mainly consist of? It consists of special bodies of armed men which have prisons, etc., at their disposal. We are justified in speaking of special bodies of armed men because the public power, which is an attribute of every state, is not directly identical with the armed population, with its self-acting armed organization. Like all the great revolutionary thinkers, Engels tried to draw attention to the class conscious workers to the very fact which prevailing Philistinism regards as least worthy of attention, as the most common and sanctified, not only by long-standing, but as one might say, petrified prejudices. A standing army and police are the chief instruments of state power, but can it be otherwise? From the point of view of the vast majority of Europeans of the end of the 19th century whom Engels was addressing, and who have not lived through or closely observed a single great revolution, it cannot be otherwise. They completely fail to understand what a self-acting armed organization of the population is. To the question whence arose the need for the special bodies of armed men standing above society and becoming alienated from it, police and standing army, the West European and Russian Philistines are inclined to answer with a few phrases borrowed from Spencer or Mikhailovsky. By referencing the complexity of social life, the differentiation of functions, and so forth. Such a reference seems scientific. It effectively dulls the senses of the average man and obscures the most important and basic fact, namely, the cleavage of society and irreconcilability of antagonistic classes. Had this cleavage not existed, the self-acting armed organization of the population might have differed from the primitive organization of a tribe of monkeys grasping sticks, or a primitive man, or of men united in a tribal form of society by its complexity, its high technique, and so forth. But it would still have been possible. It is impossible now because civilized society is divided into antagonistic and indeed irreconcilable antagonistic classes, the self-acting arming of which would lead to an armed struggle between them. A state arises, a special force is created in the form of special bodies of armed men, and every revolution, by destroying the state apparatus, demonstrates to us how the ruling class strives to restore the special bodies of armed men which serve it, and how the oppressed classes strive to create new organizations of this kind, capable of serving not the exploiters but the exploited. In the above argument, Engels raises theoretically the very question which every great revolution raises practically, palpably, and on a mass scale of action, namely, the question of relation between special bodies of armed men and the self-acting armed organization of the population. We shall see how this is concretely illustrated by the experience of the European and Russian revolutions. But let us return to Engels' exposition. He points out that sometimes, in certain parts of North America, for example, this public power is weak. He has in mind a rare exception in capitalist society in parts of North America in its pre-imperialist days when the free colonists predominated, but in general it grows stronger. Quote, it, the public power, grows stronger, however, in proportion as class antagonisms within the state become more acute and with the growth in size and population of the adjacent state. We only have to look at our present-day Europe, where class struggle and rivalry and conquest have screwed up the public power to such a pitch that it threatens to devour the whole society and even the state itself. This was written no later than the beginning of the 90s of the last century, 1890s. Engels' last preface was being dated June 16, 1891. The turn towards imperialism, meaning by that the complete domination of the trust, the omnipotence of the big banks, and colonial policy on a grand scale, and so forth, was only the beginning, and only just beginning in France, and was even weaker in North America and in Germany. Since then, a rivalry and conquest has made gigantic strides, especially as, by the beginning of the second decade of the 20th century, the whole world had finally been divided up among these rivals and conquests, i.e., among the great predatory powers. Since then, military and naval armaments have grown to monstrous proportions, and the Predatory War of 1914 to 17, for the domination of the world by England or Germany, for the divisions of the spoils, has brought the devouring of all the forces of society by the rapacious state power to the verge of complete catastrophe. As early as 1891, Engels was able to point to the rivalry and conquest as one of the most important distinguishing features of the foreign policy of the great powers. But in 1914 to 17, when this rivalry, many times intensified, has given birth to an imperialist war, the rascally social chauvinists cover up their defense of the predatory interests of their bourgeoisie by phrases about the defense of the fatherland, defense of the republic and the revolution, etc. Part 3. The state as an instrument for the exploitation of the oppressed class. For the maintenance of a special public power standing above society, taxes and state loans are needed. Quote, possessing the public power and the right to exact taxes, the officials now exist as organs of society standing above society. The free, voluntary respect which was accorded to the organs of the Gentile organization does not satisfy them, even if they could have it. Special laws are enacted proclaiming the sanctity of the and immunity of the officials. The shabbiest police servant has more authority than all the representatives of the tribe put together. But even the head of the military power of the civilized state may well envy a tribal chief the unfeigned and undisputed respect the latter enjoys. Here the question of the privileged position of the officials as organs of state power is stated. How the main point indicated is, what puts them above society? We shall see as this theoretical problem was solved in practice by the Paris Commune in 1871, and how it was slurred over in a reactionary manner by Kautsky in 1912. Quote, as the state arose out of the need to hold class antagonisms in check, but as it at the same time arose in the midst of the conflict of these classes, it is, as a rule, the state of the most powerful, economically dominant class, which through the medium of the state becomes the dominant class politically and thus acquired new meanings of holding down and exploiting the oppressed class. End quote. It was not only the ancient and feudal states that were organs for exploitation of slaves and serfs, but, quote, the contemporary representative state is an instrument of exploitation by wage labor by capital. By way of exception, however, periods occur when the warring classes are so nearly balanced that the state power, ostensibly appearing as a mediator, acquires for the moment a certain independence in relation to both, end quote. Such were the instances were the absolute monarchies of the 17th and 18th centuries, the Bonapartism of the First and Second French Empires, and the Bismarck regime in Germany. Such, we add, is the present Kerensky government in Republican Russia, since it began to persecute the revolutionary proletariat, at a moment when, thanks to the leadership of the petty bourgeois democrats, the Soviets had already become impotent, while the bourgeoisie is not yet strong enough to openly disperse them. In democratic republics, Engels continues, wealth wields its power indirectly, but all the more effectively. First, by means of direct corruption of officials, America. Second, by means of the alliance between the government and the stock exchange, France, and America. At the present time, imperialism and the domination of the banks have developed both these methods of defending and asserting the omnipotence of wealth in democratic republics. Of all the descriptions to an unusually fine art. For instance, in the very first months of the Russian Democratic Republic, one might say during the honeymoon of the union of the socialist SRs and the Mensheviks with the bourgeoisie, Mr. Palchinsky in the coalition government obstructed every measure intended for the purpose of restraining the capitalists and their marauding practices, their plundering of the public treasury by means of war contracts. When Mr. Palchinsky resigned, and of course was replaced by an exactly similar Palchinsky, the capitalists rewarded him with a soft job and a salary of 120,000 rubles per annum. What would you call this, direct or indirect corruption? An alliance between the government and the syndicates, or only friendly relations? What role do the Chernovs, Tcherselis, Avanceviskis, and Skobelevs play? Are they the direct or only the indirect allies of the millionaire treasury looters? The omnipotence of wealth is thus more secure in a democratic republic, since it does not depend on the faulty political shell of capitalism. A democratic republic is the best possible political shell for capitalism, and therefore, once capital has gained control of this very best shell, through the Palchinskis, Chernovs, Sertelis, and co., it established its power so securely, so firmly, that no change, either of persons, of institutions, or of parties in the bourgeois democratic republic can shake it. We must also know that Engels very definitely calls universal suffrage an instrument of bourgeois rule. Universal suffrage, he says, obviously summing up the long experience of German social democracy, is, quote, an index of maturity of the working class. It cannot and never will be anything more in the modern state, end quote. The petty bourgeois democrats, such as our socialist revolutionaries and Mensheviks, and also their twin brothers, the social chauvinists and opportunists of Western Europe, all expect more from universal suffrage. They themselves share and instill into the minds of the people the wrong idea of universal suffrage in the modern state. It is really capable of expressing the will of the majority of the toilers and of ensuring its realization. Here we can only note that this wrong idea only point out that Engels' perfectly clear, precise, and concrete statement is distorted at every step in the propaganda and agitation conducted by the official, i.e. opportunists, socialist parties. A detailed elucidation of the utter falsity of this idea, which Engels brushes aside, is given in our further account of the views of Marx and Engels on the modern state. Engels gives a general summary in his views in the most popular of his works in the following words, quote, the state, therefore, has not existed from all eternity. There have been societies which managed without it, which have no conception of the state and state power. At a certain stage of economic development, which necessarily bound up with the cleavage of society into classes, the state became a necessity owing to this cleavage. We are now rapidly approaching a stage in the development of production which the existence of these classes has not only ceased to be a necessity, but is becoming a positive hindrance to production. They will fall as inevitably as they arose at an earlier stage. Among them, the state will inevitably fall. Along with them, the state will inevitably fall. The society that organizes production anew on the basis of free and equal association of the producers will put the whole state machine where it will then belong, in the Museum of Antiquities, side by side with the spinning wheel and the bronze axe, end quote. We do not often come across this passage in the propaganda and agitation literature of the present-day social democracy, but even when we do come across it, it is generally quoted in the same manner as one bows before an icon, i.e., it is done merely to show official respect for Engels, and no attempt is made to gauge the breadth and the depth of the revolution that this relegating of the whole state machine to the Museum of Antiquities presupposes. In most cases, we do not even find an understanding of what Engels calls the state machine. Part 4. The withering away of the state and violent revolution. Engels' words regarding the withering away of the state are also widely known. They are also often quoted, and they reveal the significance of the customary painting of Marxism to look like opportunism so clearly that we must deal with them in detail. We shall quote the whole passage from which they are taken. Jeez. Quote, the proletariat seizes the state power and transforms the means of production into the first instance of state property. But in doing this, it puts an end to itself as the proletariat. It puts an end to all the class differences and class antagonisms. It puts an end to the state as a state. The former society, moving in class antagonisms and need of the state, that is, an organization of the exploiting classes at each period for the maintenance of its external conditions of production. That is, therefore, for the forcible holding down of the exploited class in the conditions of oppression, slavery, villainage or serfdom, wage labor, determined by the existing mode of production. The state was the official representative of society as a whole, its embodiment in the invisible corporation, but it was this only insofar as it was the state of that class which itself, in its epoch, represented society as a whole. In ancient times, the state of the slave-owning citizens, in the Middle Ages, of the feudal nobility, in our epoch, of the bourgeoisie. When ultimately it becomes really representative of society as a whole, it makes itself superfluous. As soon as there are no longer any class of society to be held in subjugation, along with the class domination and the struggle for individual existence based on the former anarchy of production, the collusions and excesses arising from these have also been abolished. There is nothing more to be repressed, which would make a special repressive force, a state, necessary. The first act in which the state really comes forward as the representative of society as a whole, taking possession of the means of production in the name of society, is at the same time its last independent act as a state. The interference of the state power in social relations becomes superfluous in one sphere after another, and then ceases of itself. The government of persons is replaced by the administration of things and the direction of the process of production. The state is not abolished, it withers away. It is from this standpoint that we must appraise the phrase free people's state, both its justification at times for agitational purposes and its ultimate scientific inadequacy, and also the demand of the so-called anarchists that the state should be abolished overnight. End quote. It may be said without fear of error that this argument of Engels, which is so singularly rich in ideas, only one point has become an integral part of socialist thought among modern socialist parties, namely that according to Marx, the state withers away, as distinct from the anarchist doctrine of abolition of the state. To emasculate Marxism in such a manner is to reduce it to opportunism. For such an interpretation only leaves the hazy conception of a slow, even gradual, change of absence of leaps and storms, of absence of revolution. The current widespread mass, if one may say so, conception of the withering away of the state undoubtedly means the slurring over, if not the repudiation of revolution. Such an interpretation is the crudest distortion of Marxism, advantageous only to the bourgeoisie. In point of theory, it is based on a disregard for the most important circumstances and considerations pointed out, say, in the summary of Engels' argument, which we have just quoted in full. In the first place, Engels, at the very outset of his argument, says that, in the assuming state power, the proletariat by that puts an end to the state as the state. It is not good form to ponder over what this means. Generally, it is either ignored altogether or it is considered to be a piece of Hegelian weakness on Engels' part. As a matter of fact, however, these words briefly express the experience of one of the great proletarian revolutions, the Paris Commune of 1871, of which we shall speak in greater detail in its proper place. As a matter of fact, Engels speaks here on the abolition of the bourgeois state by the proletarian revolution, while the words about its withering away refer to the remnants of the proletarian state after the socialist revolution. According to Engels, the bourgeois state does not wither away but is put an end to by the proletariat in the course of the revolution. What withers away after the revolution is the proletarian state or semi-state. Secondly, the state is a special repressive force. Engels gives a splendidly and extremely profound definition here with complete lucidity. And from it, it follows that the special repressive force for the suppression of the proletariat by the bourgeoisie, for the suppression of the millions of toilers by a handful of the rich, must be superseded by a special repressive force for the suppression of the bourgeoisie by the proletariat, the dictatorship of the proletariat. This is precisely what is meant by putting an end to the state as the state. This is precisely the act of taking possession of the means of production in the name of society. And it is obvious that such a substitution of one proletarian special repressive force for another bourgeois special repressive force cannot possibly take place in the form of withering away. Thirdly, in regards to the state withering away and the even more expressive and colorful ceasing of itself, Engels refers quite clearly and definitely to the period after the state has taken possession of the means of production in the name of society, that is, after the socialist revolution. We all know that the political form of the state at the time is the most complete democracy, but it never enters the head of any opportunist who shamelessly distorts Marx and that Engels, or shamelessly distorts Marxism, that Engels here is speaking of democracy withering away or ceasing of itself. It seems very strange at first sight, but it is unintelligible only to those who have not pondered over the fact that democracy is also a state, and that consequentially, democracy will also disappear when a state disappears. Revolution can alone put an end to the bourgeois state. The state in general, i.e. the most complete democracy, can only wither away. Fourthly, after formulating his famous proposition that the state withers away, Engels at once explains concretely that this proposition is directly equal against the opportunists and anarchists. In doing this, however, Engels puts in the forefront the conclusion deduced from the proposition, the state withers away, which is directed against the opportunists. One can wager that out of every 10,000 persons who have heard or read about the withering away of the state, 9,990 do not know or do not remember that Engels did not direct the conclusions he deduced from this proposition against the anarchists alone. Of the remaining 10, probably 9 do not know the meaning of the free people state, or why an attack on this watchword contains an attack on the opportunists. This is how history is written. This is how great revolutionary doctrine is imperceptibly falsified and adapted to prevailing Philistinism. The conclusions draws against the anarchists have been repeated thousands of times, vulgarized, dinned into the people's heads in the crudest fashion, and has acquired the strength of prejudice, whereas the conclusion drawn against the opportunists has been hushed up and forgotten. The Free People's State was a program demanded and a popular slogan of the German Social Democrats in the 70s. The only political content of the slogan was a pompous Philistine description of a concept of democracy, insofar as it hinted in a lawful manner that at a democratic republic, Engels was prepared to justify for its use for a time from an agitational point of view. But it was an opportunist slogan, for it not only expressed an embellishment of bourgeois democracy, but also a lack of understanding of the socialist criticism of the state in general. We are in favor of a democratic republic as the best form of state for the proletariat under capitalism, but we have no right to forget that wage slavery is the law of people, even in the most democratic bourgeois republic. Furthermore, every state is a special repressive force for the suppression of the oppressed classes. Consequently, no state is a free or a people state. Marx and Engels explained this repeatedly to their party comrades in the 70s. Fifthly, this very same work of Engels, of which everyone remembers the argument about the withering away of the state, also contains a disquisition on the significance of violent revolution. Engels' historical analysis of its role becomes a veritable panegyric on violent revolution. This no one remembers. It is not good form in the modern socialist parties to talk or even think about the importance of this idea, and it plays no part whatever in their daily propaganda and agitation among the masses. And yet it is inseparably bound up with the withering away of the state in one harmonious whole. Here is Engels' argument. Quote, that force, however, plays yet another role other than that of the diabolical power in history, a revolutionary role. That in which the words of Marx, it is the midwife of every old society that is pregnant with the new. That it is the instrument by the aid of which the social movement forces its way through and shatters the dead, fossilized political forms. Of this there is not a word in Herdering. It is only with sighs and groans that he admits the possibility that force will perhaps be necessary for the overthrow of the economic system of exploitation. Unfortunately, because all use of force, forsooth, demoralizes the person who uses it. And this in spite of the immense moral and spiritual impetus which has resulted from every victorious revolution. And this in Germany, where a violent coalition, which indeed may be forced on the people, would at least have the advantage of wiping out the servility which has permeated the national consciousness as a result of the humiliation of the 30 Years' War. And this person's mode of thought, lifeless, insipid, and impotent, claims to impose itself on the most revolutionary party which history has known. End quote. How can this panegyric on violent revolution, which Engels insistently brought to the attention of the German social democrats between 1878 and 94, i.e., the right up to the time of his death, be combined with the theory of withering away of the state to form a single doctrine? Usually the two views are combined by means of eclecticism, by unprincipled or sophisticated arbitrary selection, or a selection to please the powers that be, of one or another argument in the 99 cases out of 100, if not more often. It is the idea of the withering away that is specially emphasized. Eclecticism is substituted for dialectics. This is the most unusual and most widespread phenomenon to be met with in the present-day official social democratic literature on Marxism. This sort of substitution is not new, of course. It is observed even in the history of classic Greek philosophy. In painting Marxism to look like opportunism, the substitution of eclecticism for dialectics is the best method of deceiving the masses. It gives an illusionary satisfaction. It seems to take into account all the sides of the process and all tendencies of development, all the conflicting influences, and so forth, whereas in reality it presents no consistent and revolutionary conception of the process of social development at all. We have already said above, and shall show more fully later, that the doctrine of Marx and Engels concerning the inevitability of a violent revolution refers to the bourgeois state. The latter cannot be superseded by the proletarian state, the dictatorship of the proletariat, and the process of withering away. As a general rule, this can happen only by means of violent revolution. The panegyric Engels saying in its honor, and which fully corresponds to Marx's repeated declarations, recalling the concluding passages of the Poverty of Philosophy and the Communist Manifesto, with a proud and open declaration for the inevitability of violent revolution. Recall Marx's critique of the Gotha program of 1875, in which, almost 30 years later, he mercilessly castigates the opportunist character of that program. This panegyric is by no means a mere impulse, a mere declamation, or a polemical sally. The necessity of systematically imbuing the masses with this and precisely this view of violent revolution lies at the root of the whole of Marx's and Engels's doctrine. The betrayal of their doctrine by the new predominant social chauvinist and Kautskyan trends is brought out in striking relief by the neglect of such propaganda and agitation by both these trends. The substitution for the proletarian state by the bourgeois state is impossible without a violent revolution. The abolition of the proletarian state, i.e. the state in general, is impossible except through the process of withering away. Marx and Engels fully and concretely enlarged on these views in studying each revolutionary situation separately and analyzing the lessons of the experience of each individual revolution. We shall now proceed to discuss this, undoubtedly, the most important part of their doctrine. End of chapter 1. Thank you for joining me on this episode of the Book Club Commune. Next episode, we're reading chapter 2, The State and Revolution, the Experience of 1848 to 51. Which, if I remember correctly, it's going to go into all of the revolutions of 1848, which was a lot of revolutions at the time. A lot of revolutions in France, Hungary, Austria, Germany. So yeah, should be good. And like always, I hope you've enjoyed this episode. Please like and share and send this to all your comrades. New book. This is a really popular book. It's been done before, but it's just because this book, State and Revolution, follows imperialism in the book I'm reading from. I just decided to blow on through. Started with what is to be done. Might as well finish the entire book, you know? But as always, you know, every time I start a new book, that always is the episode people tune in for, and then very quickly people drop off. So probably we'll see the same thing for this one. But again, I hope you all enjoy it. Like and share. This will hopefully be coming out much faster than Imperialism came out. There shouldn't be like a month-long break in the middle of it. But as always, solidarity forever, and keep on reading.